This week's parsha is Parsha Mishpatim, which has a tremendous amount of details about laws of nizikin, laws of damages that happen between people. And the Torah really details for us, and it's really impossible in a survey of a couple of minutes to go through even half of the examples that are given in the parsha, but goes through basically the laws of damages that could occur and what remuneration is involved. So to give just some examples of what the Torah speaks about in practical terms, if we borrow something from a friend of ours and we do damage to it, what are our responsibilities? We rent one of these cassette tapes and it jams in our VCR, so what responsibilities do we have? We don't clean up our property properly and someone falls on it and hurts themselves, so what are the responsibilities? And this is what Parshat Mishpatim goes through. Many tractates of the Talmud are based on these laws, Baba Batra, Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, all dealing with the aspects that are found in this week's Parsha. Parsha also speaks about lending money to people and treating poor people properly. And it's as I said, Mishpatim are laws, and that's what it deals with. I'd like to focus in on two aspects. The first is the end of the parsha, and the second is the beginning of the parsha. Let's start with the end of the parsha first, because that's more challenging. The last chapter in Parshat Mishpatim, after it goes through all these laws and all the payments a person has to pay, the Torah then describes the experience at Mount Sinai. Now, if we recall, in yesterday's Parsha, in Parsha Yitro, we have a whole detailed experience of the events that happened around Mount Sinai. Just to refresh our memories in order to appreciate the difference between Parsha Yitro and what's found in Parsha Mishpatim is source number one. In last week's Parsha, Parsha Yitro, the 19th chapter, we have Moshe being told by God that you will, if you keep my mitzvot, you'll be a special treasure in Am Segula. You will be a kingdom, a priest, a Mamlechet Kohanim, a holy nation, a Goy Kadosh. And part of the prerequisites before receiving the Torah that are detailed in last week's parsha is the concept of setting a boundary around the mountain. We have in verse 12, set a boundary for the people around the mountain. Tell them to be careful not to climb the mountain or even to touch its edge. Anyone touching the mountain we put to death. So one of the things that the Torah details is before the Torah was given, Moshe is told to tell the people, don't touch. There's going to be a boundary around the mountain. You cannot go beyond that boundary. And we have once again in verse 20 as well. When Moshe goes up to Mount Sinai, God said, go back down and warn the people. They must not cross the boundary in order to see the divine. This will cause them to die. And Moshe said to God, but I just told them. This has to be a boundary. No, says God, go down. Tell them again. There must be a boundary. No one can go up and see God. So clearly a theme that we have in Parashat Yitro in describing giving of the Torah or the events preceding the giving of the Torah is the concept there must be a boundary around the mountain. The Torah is then given. We then move to chapter 21, 22, and 23, which are all the Mishpatim, all the laws we alluded to. And then the last chapter in our Parsha Mishpatim once again goes back to the Mount Sinai experience. But this Mount Sinai experience, it seems totally different from the one we just described. We take a look in verse 24, in chapter 24, the second source. God said to Moshe, go up to God along with Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu, and the 70 elders of Israel, all of you must bow down at a distance. Only Moshe will then approach God. So here already we have that there are individuals who are going up somewhat part of the mountain. Aaron, his two sons, Nadav and Avihu, the 70 elders. And then we have what we don't find in last week's parasha at all, a whole ceremony that goes on with their sacrifices and their sprinkling of the blood, and there's a book written down. And we have the people saying that famous statement of Naseh V'Nishma, and then after they said Naseh V'Nishma, there's blood sprinkled upon the people, and he said, verse 8, this is the blood of the covenant that God is making with you regarding all these words. And then where the asterisk is, Moshe then went up along with Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, and 70 of Israel's elders. They saw a vision of the God of Israel, and under his feet was something like a sapphire brick, like the essence of a clear blue sky. Boundaries, forget the boundaries. They're going up and having a vision of God. So it seems very strange. What is going on here? I mean, it's like, what is, will the real events that happen at Mount Sinai please stand up? It seems from last week's parasha, boundary, don't get near the mountain. It seems from this week's parasha, some people got up further and some even further, and they saw a vision of God, whatever that may mean. How do we understand what's going on? So indeed, as is noted in source 3, there are really two opinions of how to understand these two chapters. The opinion of Rashi is that our chapter 24 really happened before the giving of the Torah. That there was a state before the giving of the Torah, and then when God actually gave the Ten Commandments, so then that's when the boundary was established. The opinion of the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra is a different one. Where they say, as well as many others, that the Torah is in chronological order. And this is the approach I'd like to take today. Boundary around the mountain, revelation called the Ten Commandments, the Ten Utterances. Then Moshe teaches the people Parshat Mishpatim, the laws of Mishpatim. Afterwards, the next day, we then have the Brit, the covenant, and the sprinkling of the blood. And then we have Moshe, Aaron, Nadav, Avihu, and the 70 elders ascending, having a vision of God, and then Moshe himself coming close to God. We need to understand is why is there the Mishpatim in between? If one happens, if chapter 19 happens one day, and chapter 24 happens the next day, why was it necessary for the Torah to make almost like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Have the bread on one side, the bread on the other side, two revelations of godliness, and the Parsha Mishpatim found in between. What is the purpose of putting the three chapters in between these two revelations of godliness? It would make sense to have the first chapter, really godliness, Ten Commandments. Okay, the next day they made a covenant, and then people went up and saw God. Why were all these three chapters of laws necessary? Why was the peanut butter and jelly, so to use this example, necessary? That's question one. Question two, a little bit more concrete, is when the Torah begins to tell us about the laws, so we would think that the Torah would begin with laws that show something very positive about the Jewish people and about God himself. We know ourselves that when we see a book in a library, so what do we often do? We flip open the first couple of pages and we read it. Sounds interesting. I'll take out the book or I'll buy the book. So here you would think that if we are going to start the Mishpatim, the laws, which are about relationships between man and fellow man, I would start with how we lend money to people, how we borrow, we lend things or objects to people, how we have the system of borrowing. I would start in something very positive that reflects positively on us. How do we start off? What's the first law? And this is question number two. Why is this the first law? Source 4. If you buy a Jewish bondsman, he shall work for 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go free for no charge. Just to refresh our memories about this law, it's called an Eved Ivri. If a person stole an object or money and has no means to pay it back, so then instead of sending this person to jail, what we do is the Beit Din, the court of law, sells this person as a slave. This person then works for somebody for 6 years, makes back the money that he owes, that which he stole, and then in the seventh year he goes free. And the master does not only take care of this man, but he takes care of this man as well as his whole family. Just to round out the story, part of the bonus, so to speak, that this master gets is that if the man was married, this Jewish slave was married, the master would be allowed to give this Jewish slave a non-Jewish woman, and their children would become the master's children, because the children go after the mother, so the children wouldn't be Jewish. That's why if this Jewish slave says, hey, I have all these children during these 6 years, I don't want to leave my master, I love my wife, I love my second wife, I love these children, so then we pierce his ear and he becomes a slave, Idiovel, until the Jubilee, and then he's set free. This is the way we're going to begin the laws of Mishpatim.
God didn't have money to pay back, so sell him as a slave. If I had to choose of all the laws of Mishpatim to pick this one as number one, let's open the book of Mishpatim, let's hear how it's going to start, I would choose this one? Not necessarily. That's our second question. First question is, how do we understand the peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Why are the Mishpatim the laws in between the two revelations of godliness? And the second question is, if we're going to begin with laws of God is telling us between people, why is it that the law of Eved Ivri is the first law that's chosen? So I'd like to try to do is answer the first question first, and then I think that will give us guidance in the second question. It's a wonderful philosophical idea that Rav Soloveitchik notes. In the essays written by his nephew, Rav Yossi Soloveitchik, in an essay called Mi Yaleh B'Har Hashem. And he says something very fascinating. I'm going to summarize sources 6 to 11 right now. He says that there are two ways that God manifests himself, Gilui Shechina, the manifestation of godliness in the world. There's a Gilui Shechina, revelation of godliness, which is part of the laws of nature, where God said, let there be light, and there was light. This is the way that God created the world, and this is the way God still is involved in this world. If God wouldn't say, let the trees constantly grow, HaMechadesh B'tuvo B'chol Yom Tali Nasa Breshi, where God constantly renews the creation, where God is constantly involved in telling nature grow, nature function. That's one level of God's involvement in this world. It's a level that all people, every human being in this world, has a relationship with God on this level. That God is in control of nature and the world around us. So when I throw something up, I know it's going to come down. I deal with God as the laws of nature. And then there's another way God reveals himself to this world, and that's a Gilui Shechina, a revelation of godliness, of the concept, of not of Vayihi or let there be light, of rather Vishachanti B'Tocham, that God dwells among us as people, where there is a more intimate, closer relationship between us and God, wherein nature sometimes is suspended and we have what we call miracles, the Me'al LaTeva, above nature experiences. Putting it in practical terms, for oil to burn one day, that's what we call nature. For oil to burn 8 days, that's what we call above nature. And these are two ways God deals with the world, and it depends on where you're at. If you have a regular relationship with God, so then you'll have a relationship with God by he or of a natural level. But if a person is able to go beyond that and try to strive to get closer to God, so the closer a person is toward God, the closer they are to that level of a higher level of manifestation of godliness. And that's why it says the Rav, that really describes so aptly the two descriptions of revelation at God at Mount Sinai. What's chapter 19 all about? One word, boundary. That there is boundary in this world. Oil is going to last for one day. You throw something up, it's going to come down, laws of gravity. This is the level that we are skulam mikol ha'amim, we are a special treasure, which means we're like all the other nations, we're just a little bit more special. But we are going to relate to God on the level of God is up here, we're down there, and there's a boundary in our relationship. That's chapter 19. Chapter 24 tells us a whole different picture. Chapter 24 tells us if you can get beyond the relationship of boundary with God, and you're able to achieve a closer relationship, so then depending on how close your relationship is, that's how you're going to experience and have a vision of God. So Moshe goes up, Aaron goes up, Nadab and Avihu go up, the 70 elders go up. They represent people who are able to break that boundary and have a closer relationship with God. And this, says the Rav, is our challenge. Our challenge is to break the relationship of boundary relationship with God and strive to be the ones who are going up the mountain and having a revelation of God. And as he says in Source 15, Lefi HaRambam, according to Maimonides, Mechuyav HaAdam, a person's obligated, Lishof, to aspire, lahagia l'shleimut hadrusha lachalat nevuah, to a level where a person will be ready to receive prophecy. Because prophecy is not just a nice concept, rather, Ela ha'ideal shel kol Yehudi is the ideal of every Jew. Because prophecy is the concept of avod tidbak, closeness to God. As Rabbi Kagan in the Jewish Self, second chapter, notes, where he says that when God breathed in life into a person, he says, this soul, 16, gave man the ability to speak. Speech is the most rarefied form in which spiritual essence takes on particular physical expression, and as such is the bridge across which the spiritual realm actually enters physical reality. God breathes through man, for man is the one through whom the Creator connects with his creation. We are man only when we fulfill this role, and every dimension of human experience offers its own unique opportunity for doing so, whether through prayer to the Creator, contemplating the divine root of our being, or relating to the image of God which is in everyone. We must always strive to connect the finite physical world to its infinite source. And he says that prophecy, which results from seeing the world through the eyes of the Creator, is the attainment of a fully revealed connection. The prophet represents a form of the ultimate connection. In this world, the fact that God breathed life into us means that our job is to connect the physical and the spiritual together. That's our mandate. Our mandate is not to look at the world as boundary alone, but to move beyond the boundary and to take the physical and connect it with the spiritual. That's what we have within us when God breathes within us a breath of life. The prophet is the ideal person who's able to see life through the eyes of the Creator, is able to elevate all physical to the spiritual. This is what the Rambam says. This is where we need to aspire to. That we work on a level that we're not satisfied of having a relationship with God, of a regular, normal relationship. We should try to get closer and closer and closer. We should try to move beyond the boundaries where there are no boundaries and you're able to see a vision of God. How do we do this? How do we do this? How do we move from chapter 19 of boundaries to chapter 24, where people start going up to the mountain and seeing God? So I think the answer is found in a great line of the Rav in Source 18. If a person's asked, if one would ask, Yom Kippur night, you get home from shul, say 9 o'clock, usually Kol Nidre is over, right? 9:30. So who can go to sleep Yom Kippur night? Right? You're all excited. You waited for so long, since Elul, for Yom Kippur. You're going to go to sleep. So you're really inspired. After Kol Nidre, you're inspired. So you come home, and you want to learn something. This is a time, really, to learn. So you ask yourself, well, what should I learn Yom Kippur night? So the Rav says, if a person would ask, well, maybe I should learn the laws of Rambam Maimonides on Tshuva. Well, that's a good option. Maybe I should learn that. Or maybe I should learn Rabbeinu Yonah's famous book, Shari Tshuva, Gates of Repentance. That's also an option. Or maybe I should take out the Gemara, he says, and learn the laws about damages. So the first two I could hear. Take out a Talmud and learn about the laws of damages? It just doesn't seem right. With the asterisks in 18. Moshe Masar Vilimeid Halachot Elu Yisrael. Moshe taught all of these laws to Israel. Ulekulan, and to all of them, oto koach lekadesh. They all have the ability to sanctify, liromein, to elevate, uletaheret adam, and to sanctify the person. What should you learn? It doesn't matter what you learn. What will speak to you and elevate you as an individual, because all of them have the power to elevate a person. What is the bridge between chapter 19 and chapter 24, the peanut butter and jelly, the mishpatim? How do we move from a level of boundary to a level of getting up that mountain? It's not only by sitting and learning the laws of tshuva or the laws of Rabbeinu Yonah, of contemplating God. One can reach that height of closeness to God very much through the legalistic aspects of damages as well. And that's what I'd like to try to focus in on today. where the Jewish religion is not only a religion of contemplating godliness and our relationship with God, and that's how we're going to get up above the mountain, but it's very much on our day-to-day living and being careful about the way we act in terms of our laws and the way we treat other people, that's going to help us get up that mountain and closeness to God. So I'd like to show, and the challenge that I'd like to present right now is to show how the first of these laws, the law of Eved Ivri, really sets up for us the model of those footsteps up the mountain of closeness to God. The roadmap that I'd like to set up ahead of us so that we know where at least I'm going is I'd like to take a look at four different approaches of why this law was chosen as law number one. That was our second question. Why was this chosen as law number one? The first two approaches will set up the prerequisites that are necessary before even contemplating going up that mountain. What are the two prerequisites that are necessary? And then approaches three and four are two different ways of viewing how we move up the mountain. Four approaches, two prerequisites, and two ways that our guides are moving up that mountain and breaking down the boundaries. So let's start. The first approach is the approach of the Asnayim LaTorah. Rav Sorotzkin, who explains in Source 19, that perhaps a person may say that I would have thought that these laws of how to treat a Jewish servant would be the last law found in this section and not the first, for a very simple reason. We were just slaves. We know what it feels like to be slaves. Would we ever think that we wouldn't treat slaves properly? Of course we would. And indeed, we'll add parenthetically, we know that the Jewish servant was treated very well. If there's only one pillow, it went to the servant and not to the master. I mean, he was treated like a master in the house. So of course we would know how to treat this person. We just underwent this ourselves. So says the Zayim Torah, wrong. The Torah, bottom of 19, Ulam HaTarah Yardan L'Sof Da'atov V'Tchunotav Shel Adam. The Torah went down into the deep recesses of a person's mind and personality and realized that the very servant who today has experienced the difficulties of servitude, tomorrow can be the worst master of them all. There's no guarantee that those who underwent that experience will become better masters. An exact opposite. Oftentimes, they're the coolest. And as he says, again, the Simon Torah is very contemporary, he says, we have so often people who scream for freedom of rights and for equality, and then finally they get those freedom of rights and they get that equality, and now they're in control. And freedom of rights and equality go down the drain, and sometimes they're worse tyrants than the original ruling power. Prerequisite number one is you can never be too complacent and too confident in yourself. If you want to know about going up that mountain, realize that you can never be sure of yourself. Very famous Mishnah in the second chapter of Ethics of Our Father, Pirkei Avot, that says one shouldn't believe in oneself until one's day of death. And Rabbi Budim in Ethics from Sinai, Source 20, points out that each of us is a product of his experience, the result of his past, the consequence of his combined yesterdays. But the process of growth does not stop at any single point, and that's the key. It doesn't stop. I've grown. I've had a tremendous challenge in my life, and now I'm there. It's like a person who works very hard to get the gold and, you know, the runner and works and finally gets the gold medal. That's it. That's it. That's not it. That's just the beginning. Life is full of meeting these challenges. As he says so beautifully at the bottom of 20, life has been aptly described as a symphony that must be played by ear. There's no printed score to go by. We know nothing because all we can be sure of are of our yesterdays. To feel absolutely sure about yourself, your religiosity, your morality, or your future security is foolish. Prerequisite number one is one must always be on the path of growth, and one must never say, I've reached it, I'm there, let's move on. No, one's always moving. And if one isn't moving, so then one's also moving. It's called moving downhill. It's called moving downhill. Very famous story of a high priest in the times of the Second Temple who served as a high priest for 80 years. At the end of his life, became a Sadducee and didn't believe. 80 years as a high priest. No guarantees in life. That's prerequisite number one. We begin with this section because you who were slaves said, hey, I'm going to be sensitive to this person. Wrong. Never can be sure of yourself. Prerequisite number two. It's found in Rav Gedalia Shor or Gedaliahu. And he notes a very challenging idea about this Eved Ivri, this Jewish servant. He says that in reality, this individual who is sold into slavery because he stole is really guilty of many, many other crimes. God, in his mercy, had it so, set the stage so, that this person would be caught specifically in the crime of stealing to be sold into slavery to expiate this individual for his sins. So in reality, what were his sins? Many, many terrible things. But God wanted this person to go through an atonement process, so had the stage set where this person would be forced to steal, not forced to steal, would come to steal, and would then have to be sold into slavery. So the obvious question asked the Or Gedaliahu is, well, if God wanted to seek atonement for this person, so he could have done it in myriads of ways, why was it that he wanted this person to then steal and be sold as a slave? So this is the key point. He says in Source 23,
why specifically the punishment of slavery and not another punishment? And why specifically with the sin of stealing? The reason is the key of stealing is what's stealing all about? When you pretend that no one's watching above you. Had we known that someone was watching above us, we would never sin. We would never steal. And that's why he says, is that stealing is just representative of all of these sins that a person has done. Because all the sins have one common denominator. God's not watching. Stealing is just a physical manifestation of when a person takes something that doesn't belong to them. If they would know that someone's watching, so of course they wouldn't take it. If we would sin, we would know that God was watching. Of course we wouldn't sin. The problem that this person had was he didn't believe the concept that God is watching. That therefore manifested itself in sinning, and that's why the punishment is you who didn't believe that God could take care of you. So therefore, you need to have another master watching over you. As he says in 25, Hamidah kenegi midah, the measure for measure is, Shim ish kazeh shechipeis emtsaim acherim leparnasato. This person is stealing to find other means of a livelihood and did not want the adnut shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the mastery of God, so we make another master over him. Prerequisite number two is this concept of realization that God is watching over us. Stealing is a law where a person says no one is watching. That's a real reflection of so many other laws that we commit, so many other sins we commit. It's a statement that no one's watching. It reminds me of a newspaper piece that Mrs. Lansman gave me a number of weeks ago, which I think is a story which I'll just summarize very briefly, really reflects this idea. A woman gets on the bus, and she's sitting behind two young ladies who are having a conversation. And the young ladies begin talking, and they speak about how did you hear so-and-so got engaged? And the other girl says, so-and-so got engaged?
oh yeah, I can't believe she got engaged, and then started listing all the terrible things and all the bad problems that this person had. And they had this whole conversation, oh, we can't believe this person got engaged because of X, Y, Z, Q, R, and S. So the woman who gets on the bus was sitting next to another lady, also behind these two young ladies who are having a conversation. And this other lady turned to the girls and says, you know, I really think I should know more about this. I am the mother of the groom. Total silence. What do you say then? So there's this like awkward silence where you don't, you know, you put 3 feet in your mouth, forget about two. You don't know what to say. And then this woman says, I'm not the mother of the groom, but let's say I was. That's what we're talking about here. If we know that the mother of the groom is sitting behind us on the bus, so we never have this conversation. If we know that God was watching above us, we would never do half the things that we do. The real root of so many things that go on in life is the lack of the way the Shulchan Aruch begins, the code of Jewish law of this Shem Lenegdi Tamir, I place God in front of me at all times. If you place God in front of you at all times, if you realize that there's somebody watching so you won't come to steal and you won't come to do so many sins, the Torah begins off, the Mishpatim, the laws of this Eved Ivri, is to show us that the law of stealing really represents a much deeper aspect of not recognizing the Adnus, the mastery of God. And this is prerequisite number 2 in our relationship with God. If you want to get up that mountain, realize that God is watching. Realize that there's somebody to whom you need to have this relationship with, the Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, that God is before you at all times. I'll just make mention, though I will not do it, one can look at it at one's own time, verses 27 through 30, Rav Soloveitchik speaks about that this was indeed man's original sin. When Adam ate from the tree, it was really a demonstration that God, yes, he created the world, but no, he no longer has mastery over the world, and therefore I have the right to take that which I want, carte blanche privileges, and really the first transgression was a transgression of stealing, of robbery. Prerequisite number 1, never to be complacent. Prerequisite number 2, God is watching, realize that we need to have a relationship with God. Having said those 2, I'd like to now work on the positive aspects of how do we move up the mountain, how do we attain that closeness to God and break down the boundaries. This brings us to approach number 3. Why was this the first law? So here we have a very famous understanding of Rav Hirsch. I have the abridged here in source number 32. He says, we shall see that there is hardly another law as eminently suited as this one to afford us an insight into the purpose of the divine institutions of social justice and to show us how fundamentally different the character of Jewish law is from all other legal systems. We have here in the case of a thief the one sole instance in which the law of God imposes loss of freedom as a punishment, though we shall see that in fact this is not to be construed as a punishment. And in what manner is this punishment to be carried out? The law specifies that the offender must be placed with a family, just as we today might place a juvenile delinquent into a family environment. Note too, the precautions which the law enumerates for this procedure in order not to crush the offender's self-respect, so that despite the degradation he has brought upon himself, he may still feel that he is treated and respected as a brother, capable of earning and giving love. Note how the law makes sure that he can retain his contact with his family, and how he sees to it that his family should not suffer distress because of his offense. Compare that to our penal system today. A person steals, what happens? We throw him in jail. So here the guy did what we call a white college crime. And what does he learn in jail? He learns how to be a real criminal. I mean, there are some real hard cases in prison. And what happens to this person's family while he's in prison? I don't care. Whatever happens to his family, that's their problem. Compare that to the way the Jewish system of justice is. The only case, there's no prison in Judaism. The only case of where a person loses his freedom is not by putting him in a prison, but by putting him in a family that will teach him proper relationship with God, will teach him how to be a better person, will teach him how to trust God more. And this family takes care and provides for his wife and his children as well. What a system. Is this not the perfect place to begin off Parshat Mishpatim? Because this is teaching us that even in the times of strict justice, where the person needs to pay back that which he stole, within that aspect of justice is so much mercy, is so much rachamim. And this is really the theme of Parshat Mishpatim, where Mishpatim is really part and parcel connected with the concept of tzedakah, with the concept of mercy as well. The most famous example, perhaps, of this is Source 35, where we find the lawyers, if a person should steal an ox, he needs to pay 5 times the amount of the ox. And if he should steal a sheep, he only pays 4 times the amount. Ask Rashi, well, why 5 times for one and 4 times for the other? Because the way you steal the two are different. The ox you lead along the road. The sheep, what do you have to do? Carry it on your shoulder. He had to go through a little bit more difficulty in stealing the sheep. And because the robber had to go through more difficulty in stealing the sheep, and there's a certain amount of embarrassment and trouble that it took, he pays less for it. Wow. That's a system of justice we have in Judaism. That we think about the mindset of this thief. He stole, yes, he stole. But look what he had to go through to steal the sheep. He already paid back 1% amount of what he would have to owe. He only owes 4 instead of 5. Why? Because it took something out of him, more so to steal the sheep than to steal the ox. This is the Jewish system of mishpat. Yes, the guy steals, but you don't throw him in prison. You throw him in a family environment. You place him in a family environment that he knows how to become a better person. I'll just quote one more example of this, which is not found on our sheets. A little more technical, but I think shows us that this is really the theme of the parasha. We have in this week's parasha the concept of a short tam, an ox that never hurt anybody. And one day this ox got into one of its moves and decided to do damage. So the law is that the owner of the ox only pays for half the amount of damages. Not for the total amount, but half. There's an argument in the Talmud. Why does it only pay for half and not for the whole? But this is the beauty of what we're speaking about here. One opinion is very simply, an ox is an ox is an ox, and we assume that all oxes are dangerous. So the fact that your ox never did anything before because it's only been in good moods, and one day it decides to be in a bad mood, well, you're responsible for that ox. So in reality, you really should be paying, what? 100% of the damages. Because an ox needs to be watched. Will have mercy on you and only ask you to pay half because he's never done anything before. But we'll see, Mishurat HaDin, according to strict justice, you owe 100%. We'll have mercy on you because your ox never did anything before, only pay half. But there's a second view in the Talmud. The second view in the Talmud is, an ox may be an ox, may be an ox, but my ox never did anything, so my ox never did anything, and technically, you know what? I don't have to pay anything because my ox never did anything. There's no record on my ox. So technically speaking, I wouldn't have to pay anything. Ah, but if you're going to be an individual who's going to own an ox, then you're going to have to take responsibility for your ox. And there is a responsibility. If a person does damage, you should pay for the damage. Ah, I'm not going to make you pay 100%. I will make you pay 50%. So even though you really weren't responsible for your ox, you are responsible for the community. And in this way, according to the strict law, you wouldn't have to pay anything because your ox never did anything. But here, I'm going to take all that mercy and mitigate it and say, nevertheless, you have to pay half because you are responsible when damages get done. This is the theme of the parsha. The theme of the parsha is that when God has mishpat, when God has judgment, it always has mixed in mercy. The first way of getting up that mountain is the halachah, the drachah, of to follow in God's ways and not to be so stuck in life on justice. And to realize in life, when we deal with people, we need to have this element of mercy as well. Someone tells you they're going to do something and they don't do it. They break a promise. So we can be all hot under the collar, you promised me, right? Or you can say, you're right, you're wrong. I mean, you did something wrong and there has to be consequences. But I understand there may have been mitigating situations that didn't allow you to do that which you promised me to do.
You're able to view it with a view of justice. The way to climb up the mountain of Otidbach, to follow in God's ways, is to follow in the ways that God establishes in this chapter of the peanut butter and jelly, and that is to realize that within justice, there has to be mercy. And that's what the Sifti Chaim says so beautifully. We could have two people who do the exact same action and they're judged completely differently. What does it depend on? What type of person they are. If a person is always strict in life with the people around them, so God will judge them with the same amount of strictness. And if a person through life is always willing to forgive and always has the ability to judge other people favorably, so then God will treat that person in the same way. The halachta bidrachav, we should follow God's ways and mix justice with mercy, and God will treat us likewise. Final idea of getting up the mountain for today. 38. The Talmud teaches that one who wishes to become a religiously devout person should be careful regarding the laws of damages. If a person wants to be a chassid, a religiously devout person, so he should study and be careful about the laws of nezikin, of damages. This forcefully refutes the common misconception that religion is confined to ritual and temple. One who is negligent with someone else's property is as irreligious as someone who is negligent in Shabbos or Kashrut observance. Says Rabbi Ben Yerucham, Das Torah, Mashkiach of Mir, also contemporary. He says, so often, and it's almost a challenging statement, we have a closer relationship with God than we do with people around us. People are very into praying to God, doing acts of mitzvot that relate to God, and in the sense we know God better than we do people. Says Rabbi Yerucham, I'm summarizing 39 through 42 in Das Torah in this week's parasha. He said, if you want to really understand the laws of damages and to really understand all the ramifications of these laws, so prerequisite number one is to learn people. Be sensitive to people. He says, just like in medical school, you will not finish medical school without working on a cadaver and really seeing a body up close and how it functions, so too you're never going to be able to learn the laws of the Torah or dealing with damages unless you learn how to deal with people, be sensitive to people, know what it means when a person is close to an object, how a person feels about their property. If you don't know a person and the way people work in life, so you can't possibly learn about damages. That's why he says, for example, when the Torah tells us in this week's parasha, if you should lend money to a poor person, imach, with you. So that, which means that a poor person among your midst. So Rashi, based on the Medrash, says, what does imach mean, with you? That in order to lend to another person money, pretend you're that poor person. Feel what it's like to be a poor person. Feel what it's like not to have food. Feel what it's like to be hungry. Feel what it's like to be cold. Feel what it's like to be without the self-respect. When you've really gotten down to understanding what this feeling is all about of being poor, now you can lend money. Because now you know what it's going to be like to lend money. And you're going to lend money properly. You know how to get up the mountain? Parsha Mishpatim is not about all these laws of religious observance. It's laws about how to treat another person properly. To get up the mountain means to be a sensitive person to another person. To be able to study the person near us and to know what they need. When you're able to come to that closeness of the people around you and sensitivity to the people around you, so then you're walking in God's ways and you're getting closer up that mountain. It reminds me of a short vignette of a student who's asked by his teacher, do you help your wife Erev Shabbos before Shabbos with a household preparation? To which the student responded, of course I do. There's so many incidences in the Talmud which speak about the importance of Hachana L'Shabbos, preparation for Shabbos. And I too want to be part of this commandment of preparing for Shabbos. So the teacher said, that's very nice, but you have the totally wrong focus. Helping your wife
on Friday before Shabbat shouldn't be because you want to have these nice preparations for Shabbat. It's something called a wife who's under stress, who's under pressure, and it's something called ben adam l'chaveiro, man between man, to help another person out. Know what your focus and your priority should be. So often we sometimes get so caught up on all these religious fervors that we forget about the person near us. It's like stepping over all the people around us to make sure we get to a mitzvah on time. Be sensitive to the people around us. How do you get up the mountain? You get up the mountain by learning the laws of nezikin, the laws of when we damage something that belongs to a fellow and what it means to be connected to a fellow. And this is the last of the interpretations of why we begin off with Eved Ivri, and then we'll summarize, which is really diametrically opposite our first one. And that's the Ramban Nachmanides, who says, source 43, the Ramban explains that the freedom of these servants after 6 years is a reminder of Israel's own freedom from Egyptian slavery. We begin off with the slavery because you felt slavery so recently. And if you really want to be able to uphold the laws in this section, you have to feel them. You have to become part of them. We begin off with slavery because you just felt slavery. And now that you know what it feels like, you're going to be a more sensitive person. Use that as a model for all the laws in this parsha. Get to know people around you. Get to be sensitive to people who are in your midst. If you have this sensitivity to people, so then you'll be able to appreciate the world around you. You won't speak bad about a person because you'll feel that person's pain, knowing that they're the mother-in-law sitting behind you on the bus. You'll feel the person. You will not come to doing so many things that we do. It will give us a whole different perspective, and it will make us into religious people, people who are chassidim, devout people, people who can climb up that mountain. To summarize what we've seen today, two different accounts of what happened at Mount Sinai. One, chapter 19, boundaries, happened before the giving of the Torah. The Torah was given, the Ten Commandments, the Ten Utterances, then the Mishpatim, then the civil laws were given. And after that, chapter 24, the other part of the bread, we have another revelation of God wherein people are able to come up on different levels and see godliness. What's the bridge between chapter 19 and chapter 24? It's a difference between having a relationship with God that's bounded or an unbounded relationship, trying to bring the spiritual into the physical. The difference that bridges the two are Mishpatim, the Jewish laws. And what I'm trying to suggest today is that the law of Eved Ivri, the law of the Jewish servant, is the perfect bridge between those two gaps. It gives us two prerequisites. One, never be so self-complacent to think that I'll never fall. We always have to be working on ourselves. Prerequisite number two, Shiviti Hashem L'negdi Tami, place God in front of us at all times. The root of stealing is a lack of recognition that God is watching, which is the root of so many of our sins. And then that's the two prerequisites. How do we get up the mountain? One, we walk in God's ways of not only having strict justice in life, but we are able to mesh in mercy with justice. That poor guy has to schlep the sheep, has to pay less. And finally, it's the sensitivity to people. When we learn the laws of Nezikin, we're able to feel what our friend is like. That sensitivity to the people around us, specifically learning the laws of damages, that's what's going to make us into a religious person who's going to be able to come closer to God, break out of the boundaries, and have that close relationship with God.